This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flint.
Well, Margaret, we're getting a clearer picture on how the Trump administration will be shaping up. His choice for secretary for the Department of Health and Human Services, six-term Republican Representative Tom Price, an orthopedic surgeon from Georgia, and one of the first members of Congress to draft a full piece of legislation aimed at replacing the Affordable Care Act.
Well, that Price nomination has been met with some optimism from the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, and others within the healthcare industry. But, of course, that hasn't been unanimously viewed positively.
The HHS secretary governs so many health-related entities, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institute of Health.
And I think we can look forward to some very interesting and robust confirmation discussions. The incoming administration, you know, has made some promises to repeal and replace the health care law, but there's some very complex political strategies that will be required to achieve that end and complex legislative strategies. So things still very much in flux, Mark.
Something more akin to repeal and delay may come into play after 2018, which would give policymakers some time to figure out just what replace policy would actually look like.
It's interesting to note some of the advisors that have been brought in to help shape the president-elect's health policies. Among them is Cleveland Clinic president and CEO Toby Cosgrove, who presides over one of the world's top-ranked hospital systems. And of course, we had the opportunity to interview him here on Conversations and to get some of his thoughts. So we thought this would be a great opportunity to revisit that episode. He's expanded the Cleveland Clinic model of care around the country and the globe.
And we're joined by managing editor of factcheck.org, Lori Robertson, always hunting down misstatements about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can always hear our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, you can email us at chcradio@chc1.com.
Or find us on Facebook or at CHC Radio on Twitter. And we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Toby Cosgrove in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Healthcare spending is on the rise. For the first time since the Great Recession of 2008, healthcare spending rose in 2015 at a clip of about 5.8% after several years of historically low increases. The average healthcare spend per person in this country is now just under $10,000 per year per person. The rise in spending on health insurance due to the mandate under the Affordable Care Act was one catalyst for the rate of increase, and the dramatic rise in prescription drug prices in recent years also a key contributor. While the healthcare law has led to the lowest rate of uninsured residents ever, the flip side of this issue is more American health consumers are using those benefits and spending more as a result. The federal government is now the largest payer for health care, 29% versus 28% for households and 20% for businesses. Conversely, Medicare was a bright spot in the report, growing by only 4.5%. This in spite of the fact that roughly 10,000 baby boomers age into Medicare every single day. Meanwhile, with the specter of repeal of the Affordable Care Act looming under the incoming administration, many poor Americans could be losing their coverage in coming years, and there's concern that a long relied upon safety net, Planned Parenthood, could be lost to them as an option as well. President-elect Trump has vowed to end funding for Planned Parenthood, which provides medical care from primary care services to family planning and cancer and STD screenings. Millions of mostly poor Americans receive some kind of care at one of Planned Parenthood's hundreds of clinics around the country. Only 3% of their overall services are devoted to abortion, which is not paid for with government funding. As far as family planning services go, under the Affordable Care Act, birth control is covered by insurance with no copay. That provision was felt to be objectionable by many in conservative circles, leading to several high-level lawsuits challenging the matter in the courts. Meanwhile, according to a new report released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, fertility rates for women aged 15 to 44 are at their lowest rates ever recorded. In 2010, there were 6.4 babies born to every 100 women of childbearing age. In early 2016, that number has dropped to 5.9 babies per 100. This revelation follows an ongoing trend. Birth rates have declined 10% since 2007. The biggest drop was in teen birth rates, And the rate also dropped significantly for young women up to age 29. And once you are born, how long you live depends pretty significantly on how much money you have. According to the study, white wealthy males lived 7 years longer on average and white wealthy women 10 years longer. The study points to the need for more public health policies that tackle the social determinants of health, poverty, poor housing, nutrition, education, and lack of access to a healthy lifestyle. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Delos Toby Cosgrove, president and CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, a cardiovascular surgeon. He spent his early career as chief of the U.S. Air Force casualty staging flight in Vietnam, earning the Bronze Star during his service. He joined Cleveland Clinic in 1975, rising to chairman of the Department of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery in 1989. A talented innovator, Dr. Cosgrove has developed over 30 medical patents and marshaled development of the Cleveland Clinic and innovation model. He's published 450 peer-reviewed articles, medical training manuals, and the book, The Cleveland Clinic Way. Dr. Cosgrove has earned numerous awards and distinctions, including the Woodrow Wilson Center Award for Public Service. He earned his medical degree at the University of Virginia and completed residencies at Brooke General Hospital in London and Mass General in Boston. Dr. Cosgrove, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Hello. Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great. And may we live in interesting times. And
we do.
And Cleveland Clinic has been at the forefront, a real leader in so many transformations. And, you know, your health system is constantly in the top five across the country. And certainly your leadership in the thoracic and cardiovascular department had them ranked number one in the nation for 10 years in a row. So you've set the bar extremely high for quality care. And you've talked about very eloquently the Cleveland Clinic Way, and I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners the essential hallmarks of this internationally acclaimed health system you've helped create.
Well, we're really quite a different organization. We're, first of all, a group practice, and we have 3,400 physicians in it, and we are all salaried. There's no financial incentives for doing more or doing less. We have one-year contracts. In fact, I've had 39 one-year contracts. And we have annual professional reviews, all of which I think leads to the emphasis on quality and performance as an organization that is united in its care for patients.
I wonder if I could, for a moment, Dr. Cosgrove, talk about the Cleveland Clinic mantra of the right care at the right place at the right time. So many care delivery innovations are being developed now to bring the care of the American patient to the places where they spend most of their time, and we know that that's mostly not in our healthcare facilities. So we've seen the growing trend and been engaged in the trend of healthcare delivery in settings like school-based health centers, the satellite clinics, all facilitated by the proliferation of telehealth and wearables and remote monitoring. Tell us a little bit about how you are utilizing some of these emerging care models at Cleveland Clinic and how they help address this challenge of meeting patients where they actually live, work, learn, and play.
Well, first of all, we think that healthcare needs to be put together as a system, an entire system. It goes all the way from the home, ultimately through a hospital, through rehabilitation, and back home again. And increasingly, we want to concentrate on keeping people well and giving them access to healthcare when we need it. And so the first thing that we did is a number of years ago, we initiated same-day access so that you can call up and see a physician on the same day. And we've now taken that to the point where you can make your appointment either online or, frankly, you can walk in. Also, we're beginning to try to take the care increasingly to the patient. We have virtual visits. You can see a Cleveland Clinic caregiver now on your iPad. And so we think that that is going to have enormous benefits, both for the doctor and for the patient. We think it's going to enhance the patient's satisfaction. And it's also going to be good for the doctor so that they can be more efficient in the use of their time. So our mantra is access anywhere, anytime. We've also begun to do one other thing, to begin to try and take the care to people where they are. Then we put together what we call a mobile stroke unit. And when someone calls 911 with the symptoms of a stroke, we dispatch an ambulance that has a CAT scanner in it. And the CAT scan then can be done right in the driveway of the patient's home, cutting down on the amount of time before you get to therapy. We've seen some remarkable results from that, with people going from being paralyzed on one side of their body to completely normal by saving the time to get them to therapy. So care is really changing, and we're trying to knit together outpatient facilities, everything from CVS to family health centers to community hospitals to high-tech major medical centers, each connected by a transportation system and an electronic medical record.
I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners, talk a little bit about the Cleveland Clinic innovation model and how you've structured it and funded it and what's in the pipeline that's very promising that might make a difference.
Innovation is really in our DNA. Some of those, probably the more famous ones, were the coronary bypass surgery and coronary angiography. So when I first started to develop some things, we thought, well, gosh, you know, maybe we can put together a system that will expedite getting good ideas out. So we put together what we call Cleveland Clinic Innovations. And this is essentially a tech transfer organization that scouts the organization for new ideas and then helps them get commercialized. We may start a small company to do that. We've spun off now about 70 companies. And one of the recent ones was a company called Explorus. It had the idea of bringing together clinical data and major amounts of it for analysis, and they collected 50 million patients' records. And if you want to find out how many patients are 35 years old who are diabetic or taking X number of X drug, and that was recently purchased by IBM. And as you know, IBM has developed Watson.
You know, Dr. Cosgrove, I know that you are a big believer in learning from failures as well. What have you learned from the failures from your earlier days as a cardiac surgeon or your more recent incarnation as a CEO running such a large healthcare organization?
Actually, you know, just let's going back to clinical practice, you know, I did a huge number of cardiac surgical patients, and I don't remember any of my successes. I remember the ones that I had that failed. I remember one of the things that I thought about early on was trying to close holes in hearts by folding up an umbrella and putting it on the end of a catheter. And, well, I eventually took it to the company, and the company I was working with finally decided that no one would ever treat the heart with a catheter. And I guess what I learned from that was, you know, you can't get something done before it's time. And when I first came out as CEO, I thought that one of the things I'd like to see people do is travel and get new ideas and bring them back and incorporate them into the Cleveland Clinic's therapy. And I said, you can go any place in the country or the world that you want to get good ideas and bring them back to us. So nobody took me up on that opportunity. And I just kind of dropped it when no one picked it up. And I think you have to learn that you have to be very persistent with an idea and keep pushing it. And it takes time for it to get acceptance. I think probably it was a reasonable idea, but it just I didn't put enough effort to it.
We're speaking today with Dr. Toby Cosgrove, President and CEO of Cleveland Clinic. And it's since expanded the Cleveland Clinic presence to a number of communities around North America, and also with the new state-of-the-art Abu Dhabi facility in the United Arab Emirates. You've erected a state-of-the-art health system in the Middle East based on your model, and maybe give us a sense of its size and shape and what you expect to do there.
One of the things that happened to us is after 9/11, we got a lot of invitations from different countries to go places, and we had a wonderful opportunity to go to Abu Dhabi, and they wanted Cleveland Clinic, and we thought that this is really about not just putting our name there, but in fact doing what we call a cultural transfer. So they built with us a 22-story, 4 million square foot facility, and we completely staff it and run it. A third of the doctors who are there now are from Cleveland, and the rest from the United States and Europe. And we're in the process of starting a long-term relationship with them, and the idea is to bring our culture to that area of the world. We've learned an enormous amount in the process. It's almost like getting paid to go to school. We didn't know anything about expanding distantly or internationally. We've learned a lot about that, about working with other partners, about working in a different country, and how you design, staff, bring up a hospital of this magnitude a long ways away. So that has been a tremendous learning experience for us. And we're now in the process of trying to replicate that in London.
Well, I hear a sort of continuing theme in your work of innovation. So as we think about the United States, and certainly we've seen a lot of innovation in recent years, some of it may be spurred by the Affordable Care Act and more people having access to insurance, a lot of it being spurred by data and by technology. And I wonder, thinking about the United States as our practices, our hospitals, our healthcare organizations struggle to become more and more data-driven to contain costs, to improve outcomes. What are the technologies and trends that you think are going to move the United States health system forward more rapidly in that direction?
Well, first of all, I think one of the things that the Affordable Care Act has done is begin to bring us together as a healthcare delivery system. We recognize that we have been a cottage industry over time, and we're now seeing healthcare systems come together. And as healthcare systems come together, we're starting to look at the data so that we can understand how we can drive efficiency and affordability. And we are an incredibly data-driven organization. And right now, we're wondering, you know, how we're going to manage all this data. And clearly, it's going to take a whole lot of artificial intelligence, I think, is going to be a huge help for us dealing with this data. Because we hope that we're going to get to the point where we see identify people actually before they get sick, and we figure out what the most efficient way to keep them healthy and keep them out of the hospital is. Vast amounts of data to do that. And the Watsons of the world, I think, are going to be a big help with us as we do that.
You know, you've got such a great perch in this sort of global health arena. United States, the Canadian system, the national health system in the UK. And, you know, I'm wondering about this issue of attracting the best and brightest people to come and stay with you. And certainly there's been a lot of conversations going about the provider community and burnout. I know the sort of three values that we look at when we're thinking about people coming on board is certainly the sense of they want to work in an organization that has purpose. I'm wondering what your thought is about how organizations should be dealing with these large transformations that are going on in the healthcare system and how we make sure that clinicians stay engaged and involved and active participants.
Well, I think you bring up a very, very important topic, and data suggests that there's probably 50% of the physicians across the country are experiencing some sort of disenchantment or burnout with the healthcare delivery system and with their careers. And there's probably several things that are accelerating, and maybe three that I think are most important. First of all, the Affordable Care Act is changing everything about how healthcare is delivered and paid for. There are more quality metrics. You're getting paid now for delivering value as opposed to just volume. So doctors are having to change enormously about how they practice medicine, and that's not easy for anybody to make major changes. The second one that is huge is the explosion in technology. And if you look at just the technology around the electronic medical record, last year our physicians had to answer 3.5 million emails from patients. There are huge demands on doctors that go beyond what the normal patient visit is. And then you look at the explosion that's going on in new knowledge, and the total amount of knowledge in healthcare doubling every 2 years, with 40,000 journals turning out 880,000 articles a year. So there's terrific pressures on physicians, and I think what we have to do with physicians is to listen to them. We have to solicit their ideas on how to bring joy into caring for people and to remind them why we all became physicians. And that's really about putting patients first and caring for them with empathy around their issues. So we are in the process of really attacking this problem on multiple fronts. A lot of it is about communication, about how you get the objectives of the organization out to physicians and how people communicate amongst themselves and amongst all the caregivers.
I'd like to talk about another issue, and that's medical errors and their impact on our patients. And we've confirmed what we've known for a long time, that about 250,000 deaths per year are linked to medical mistakes and errors. And I think you have a very interesting approach to the problem at Cleveland Clinic, where you've really made a huge commitment to transparency. And I understand actually post an annual report on all patient outcomes, including medical errors. Tell us about that process.
Well, we've started as an organization about a decade ago putting out what we call outcomes books. And first of all, we think that it's very important that we look at our own results in a very analytical way, because every time we do that, we find that there are things that we're not doing as well as we should, and we can begin to examine those in a rational way. And as we have done that, we've seen the results improve. The second reason that we thought it was important to do it and was the fact that we are a community resource, and we owe it to report to the community how we're doing and to be absolutely transparent about those outcomes. Now, we're transparent both externally and internally, and in fact, we post scores that doctors have as far as patient satisfaction is concerned by name and rank order. And we also realize that doctors are very competitive and no one signed up to be last on the list. And we've seen their scores that we post, and we find as many things as a document as possible and provide those. And as we do that, it lists the entire organization. So we are huge believers in that. Now, as far as medical errors are concerned, we adopted a policy, again, about a decade ago that said, look, if we think that we have committed an error which has harmed a patient, we go to the patient and tell them about it. And rather than trying to hide it and hope that it doesn't result in a malpractice suit. We think that that sort of transparency goes with honesty and the best interests of everybody involved.
You know, as the CEO and really somebody who just is really leading the strategy of Cleveland Clinic, you're somebody who's certainly concerned or well aware of where you've come from. In some ways, that's the best way to know where you're headed. But I'm wondering, as you sort of pull the thread and look out into the future, what are the values that might be different? You've been one who's been articulating out the patient care and patient experience as fundamental to what you do. How do you see things evolving out in the distant future?
Well, if you look at where we are right now and what we're trying to do, we're trying to improve quality. We're trying to improve access, and we're trying to make it more affordable. Now, all those are going to result in multiple changes. You're going to change where you get your care. You're going to change who cares for you. Diseases are going to be different, and you're going to see different therapies. Now, by way of where you're going to get your care, we're seeing more and more care being done as outpatients and less the hospital, the center of healthcare delivery. You're seeing more and more advanced practice nurses and PAs helping to meet the demand that there are for services. The diseases that we're going to be treating are going to be increasingly chronic diseases rather than acute diseases, and they're going to be cared for as outpatients and in homes, at home. And the technology is going to be less and less invasive as we go forward. I think the whole landscape is undergoing an enormous change. I look at this as the biggest change that's happened in healthcare in the century.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Delos Toby Cosgrove, President and CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, one of the world's leading healthcare institutions. You can learn more about their work by going to clevelandclinic.org or follow them on Twitter at Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Cosgrove, thank you so much for the work that you do, have done, and will do, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President-elect Donald Trump claimed that in many cases, people have two jobs and, quote, some of that is because of Obamacare. In fact, the percentage of all U.S. workers holding multiple jobs has declined on an annual average basis under President Barack Obama. Trump made the claim on December 1st in Cincinnati, the first stop on what he is calling a victory tour. Trump said he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and blamed the law for forcing people to hold two jobs. Certainly, some people are working two jobs, but anecdotes are not evidence. And data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show the percentage of workers with multiple jobs has gone down under Obama, irrespective of the health care law. BLS uses data from the Census Bureau's current population survey. The annual average of multiple job holders as a percentage of all U.S. workers was 5.2% in 2008, the year before Obama took office, and it remained at 5.2% in Obama's first year in 2009. The Affordable Care Act was enacted in March 2010, and it required individuals to have health insurance or pay a tax penalty beginning in January 2014. Yet there has been little or no change in the annual average of multiple job holders since 2010. The average percentage of workers holding multiple jobs fell to 4.9% in 2010 and has remained at that level every year since then. The average over the first 11 months of this year is 5%, a slight increase from 2015, but still below the annual average for all the years before Obama took office. In April 2015, the BLS published an analysis of the trend in multiple job holding from 1994 to 2013, concluding that, quote, multiple job holding has become less common in the United States over the past two decades. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. One in six people in the world lacks access to drinking water or basic sanitation, and statistics show that diarrhea is the leading cause of death for these populations, but access to clean and potable water continues to present a real challenge. In Africa, the numbers are staggering, with 46% of the residents of sub-Saharan Africa having no direct access to clean water. In 2005, artist Tracy Hawkins went to Tanzania to see what she could do about it. Clay pot water filtration has been around for several hundred years, where simple clay pots lined in the bottom with silver oxide can remove up to 99% of the impurities from most water sources, but no one had undertaken a dedicated program to produce and distribute these pots. Tracy founded the Singisi Pottery Project with a local activist and began making the pots with local artisans in this region of Tanzania. By 2008, she and her team were able to get a factory built so that they could increase production. The project has served multiple communities and continues to expand. And the best part, the health of entire communities has been improved significantly once each village resident is provided with a clay filtration system. The pots are inexpensive to produce, easy to handle, and the factory has also created jobs for local residents. A simple, easily manufactured solution that improves access to potable water for a community that previously had few options, one that improves health, well-being, and economic conditions at the same time. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.